Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We do have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. But first, Ian, I must eat a little bit of humble pie or crow, whatever. It all started last week. Jim and I were talking about Hugh Hewitt's 180 whiplash on what Republicans should do about Donald Trump. A week earlier, he said that Trump was a stage four cancer, a plane crashing into the mountain, had to be dealt with. Seemed like he wanted the Republicans to run out Trump at the Republican National Convention. A week later, he writes an opinion piece for the Washington Post saying, no, Republicans have no choice but to stick with Trump. And it's either Trump or Hillary Clinton, so Republicans have to stick with Trump. So I suggested at the time that he was worried about the NBA Finals because he was a huge Cleveland fan in all sports. And at the time, it was a 3-2 Warriors lead in the NBA Finals. And I said, ultimately, Hugh's worries wouldn't matter because the Warriors were going to win the title. Even after the Cavaliers won Game 6, I said the Warriors were going to win the title. On Sunday night, they most certainly did not win the title. Cleveland did. First time a road team has won Game 7 of the NBA Finals since 1978. Cleveland gets its first major sports title in 52 years. So it's a sweet moment for the city, Ian, and I'm sure it'll be just as sweet when they get their next one in 2068. The Cavaliers got it done. Congratulations again to Cleveland. Two silver linings here, though, as I see it for me. Number one, as long as Bill Kristol is still alive, I'm not the worst predictor in Washington. And secondly, since the Warriors lost, the 1995-96 Chicago Bulls are still the greatest NBA team of all time. Ian, I'm not sure you have any humble pie to eat on this issue or not, but hopefully you enjoyed the finals.
Indeed, indeed. And that's quite an act of humility there, Greg, and I applaud you on it. And in your defense, you know, who would have expected the Golden State would go 73-9 in the regular season and then 15-9 in the postseason? So the statisticians, I think, were far off on that one, too. But yeah, absolutely. Congratulations to Cleveland. And now when the Indians win the World Series, that will be... Hell will have officially frozen over, I think.
Well, you know, they did have a really good team a number of years ago. It had, I mean, when they had Bob Uecker doing the announcing and Charlie Sheen and Tom Berenger was on the team, Corbin Burnson, very strong Indian team.
That was a great roster. I remember that lineup.
All right, on to our real job now and on to the good martini, and that is that there's been a major shakeup in the Trump campaign. Corey Lewandowski, of arm-grabbing fame from earlier this campaign season, is out as campaign manager. Donald Trump making the call apparently this weekend at the behest of several members of his family. Quite a change for Trump, who made a big deal of the fact that he was sticking with Corey during the whole Michelle Fields controversy. Corey Lewandowski, certainly one of the more checkered figures, not only in this campaign, but also throughout his own political career. So major change at Trump headquarters.
Yeah, I think it's good news in this sense. Lewandowski's something of a thug, and we learned that over the course of the campaign, and he has a tendency to be a nasty individual, and getting him out of the limelight is just as well. It is a curious thing, though, and a couple questions are worth asking. The first is, okay, why now, given that he was under significant pressure a couple months back to do this, and not only, as you pointed out, defended him, but then also attacked Ted Cruz for being disloyal when he dumped one of his campaign chiefs, saying, you know, he fired him like a dog, used him as a scapegoat, etc. It's a little bit of hypocrisy on Trump's part here. Secondly, how this happened is kind of curious. Apparently, the reporting is coming out that, of course, Paul Manafort wanted this, and there's been a lot of scuttlebutt from inside the Trump campaign about how Lewandowski and Manafort have been at each other's throats for the past couple months. But it wasn't apparently only the Manafort wanted it. Apparently, the family wanted it, too. And I just think this is a point worth making sort of tangential to this whole episode, which is that the whole Trump campaign operates within the Trump bloodline. It's the weirdest thing. I mean, the deciding factor in this termination was the fact that Ivanka wanted it. At least that's the reporting at the moment. You know, Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, you know, these are the people who are sort of calling the shots. people joke about Trump being sort of a mafia style candidate, and I don't want to push that too far, but it's a bizarre thing that basically all of Trump's executive staff is his own blood kin. And is that going to be would that be what a Trump White House looks like? You know, are all the shots going to be called, by Ivanka and Donald Jr.? I mean, it's a bizarre, bizarre situation. So just something else worth noting in all of this. My guess, of course, is that Trump's been looking at the poll numbers, which have been sagging, to put it gently, and wanted to reassure some higher ups that he's getting ready to run a more disciplined campaign. That's hard to fathom, though, given the fact that he's been outspent 100% by Hillary Clinton over the past month, and also that now with the termination of Corey Lewandowski, he officially cut 3% of his entire campaign staff. It's an interesting situation. We'll see what the fallout is over the next 48 hours or so.
All right, Ian, on to the bad martini now. And it's been a little over a week since the horrific terrorist attack at the Pulse Club in Orlando that left 49 people dead and more than 50 injured. The investigation has taken a number of twists and turns, but one of the more concerning things, really, that's come out is just in the past day or so, courtesy of Attorney General Loretta Lynch speaking with Chuck Todd on NBC's Meet the Press. When Chuck Todd asked her if there are any emerging details that were going to be released about this investigation, Loretta Lynch says, yes, we're going to release some of the 911 transcripts when the killer called 911. And then we got this exchange.
What we're announcing tomorrow is that the FBI is releasing a partial transcript of the killer's calls with law enforcement from inside the club. That'll be coming out tomorrow, and I'll be headed to Orlando.
Did you say partial? What's being left out?
Well, what we're not going to do is further proclaim this individual's pledges of allegiance to terrorist groups and further his propaganda.
So we're not going to hear him talk about those things?
We will hear him talk about some of those things, but we're not going to hear him make his assertions of allegiance and that.
Ian, we can't possibly release all the transcripts, including the part where he clearly explains what motivated the attack. That would ruin the narrative.
Right, exactly. What? I mean, we're going to give you these transcripts, and basically in the redacted parts, just read in ISIS, right? I mean, that's effectively what she's saying, although in effect what she wants is for people to read in, National Rifle Association. This is just astonishing. There are two points. One, it's exactly what you're saying. It's just narrative crafting, on completely specious grounds that somehow this is going to encourage ISIS or it's going to, hurt the victims to have the actual motives proclaimed or, all the other nonsense that's being peddled by the White House. And secondly, this is the reason that people don't trust the Obama administration. I mean, not to give enormous credit to Trump fans, but if you look at the past 8 years and you say, I don't trust them, and then they do this, all your suspicions are seemingly confirmed. It's just the most outrageous distortion of a reality that everyone already knows. It's so transparent. Hard to get your mind around how the administration thinks that this serves any purpose.
Ian, there was a little bit of pushback, at least a follow-up question there from Chuck Todd about the fact that this was going to be redacted with no references to what motivated the attack. How surprised are you that the media is not more concerned about this or that even most Republicans aren't saying much about it today? Is this just how much we've come to expect this from this administration?
Right. I mean, I think this is thinking longer term and a little more broadly. I mean, this is the type of stuff that just serves to sever all bonds of trust between a citizenry and its leadership. You know, the default mode becomes they're lying to us. We don't trust what they're saying. It's all propaganda. And you take that as the default. And then when they say something that turns out to be true or trustworthy, everybody says, wow, we didn't expect that. It's a very unhealthy situation to put it lightly. I mean, it's just the default should be the opposite. We should be able to say, when they come out with a transcript, they come out with a transcript and we can read it and trust that they're not trying to hide anything from us. But over the past 8 years, the entire MO of the administration has been to craft politically convenient narratives. I mean, the Ben Rhodes Iran episode is the sort of point in case. So I think you take all of these things together, and no wonder you have a general electorate that's just enormously distrustful of their leaders.
All right, on to the crazy martini now. And it's been a crazy political year, to say the least. But back when Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, announced that he was running for president, he made it pretty clear he was not going to run for U.S. Senate. And he made that clear even after he dropped out of the presidential race in March following his defeat in the Florida primary. And he kept saying that and kept saying that and kept saying that. And now all of a sudden we're 4 days away from the filing deadline, and it appears that Marco Rubio might be running for Senate this year. The rumor mill really got ginned up late last week when David Jolly, a congressman from Florida, announced he was no longer running for the Republican Senate nomination to replace Rubio, saying he was going to go back instead and run for his House seat. And he was giving huge hints that Marco Rubio is going to get back in this thing and actually run for a second term in the U.S. Senate. So there's still a pretty crowded field here. You've got a strong conservative congressman in Ron DeSantis. You've got the lieutenant governor. You've got a businessman in this race who I believe is actually leading in the polls at this point. And so, Ian, it's just bizarre that all of these different assumptions are being made. Rubio has not said much at all, and he's only got 4 days to do it all. So if he's going to do it, just do it. Why all this cloak and dagger?
Yeah. So here's why this is kind of crazy, in my opinion. One is, for all his faults, I like Marco Rubio a lot. I like him in the Senate. I'd love to see him in the Senate for another term. But there are a couple things. One is, you remember when Rand Paul did the sort of shenanigans to manipulate the rules in Kentucky so that he could run for the Senate as well as for the presidency? And we all said, you know, look, make a decision. We don't need to be tailoring the laws to individuals, even individuals that we might like. This is a bad road to go down. Marco Rubio said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to pick a side. I'm going to pick a path. And he did. And now he seems to be going back on that. That's the first thing. The second is, he's been cracking this door a little bit over the past couple weeks. And then after Orlando, there was, well, this really, made me rethink, and I need to talk to my family and see how best I can serve, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe that's true. Or more likely there's an element of truth in that. But look, if you want to be in the Senate, Marco, just be in the Senate. Run. there's no reason to dance to try and make this, make this a situation in which you've been sort of put upon to come back and do your grand duty. You know, if you want to be in the Senate, just do it. You'll get support. Well, a lot of people still like you, et cetera, et cetera. That's the reason that it kind of frustrates me. I'm very sympathetic to ambition. If you want to be in the Senate, run for the Senate. The last thing is, and the one maybe drawback to this, is he's going to have a tough race. And the sort of pussyfooting around making a decision could potentially hurt him as he tries to, assuming he does get in here, and we'll find out, but assuming he does, it could sort of dampen the rollout here, the sort of grand comeback narrative that he needs. And if he gets into this race, either half-heartedly or not thinking through this clearly, he's going to be risking a lot. And it's one thing to run for the presidency and not get it. You're young, you can do it again. But if he were to run and lose this seat, it could potentially be, disastrous. The bottom line is, this is just sort of a bizarre situation. And like I said, I like Marco Rubio a lot, but we need some clarity on this.
Ian, as we established earlier, my predictor's card has been temporarily suspended due to extreme inaccuracy. What's your read on Rubio? Does he get in this race? And if so, does he win?
Yeah, I do think he gets in. And yes, I think he wins, but I think it's going to be a closer race than a lot of people predict. And if he were to lose, I wouldn't be shocked.
Ian, great to have you as always. Thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. Jim will be back on Tuesday. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.